Welcome to Teneo Insights, a podcast that provides in-depth analysis on the issues that matter most to CEOs and their businesses. I'm your host, Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. Let's get started.
Alan Murray is with me today. He's a noted author and journalist. He is the CEO of Fortune Media, overseeing all business and editorial operations of that iconic American business publication that was founded by Henry Luce 93 years ago, auspiciously first published, actually, a month before the great stock market crash of 1929. Alan writes Fortune's widely read CEO Daily newsletter, and he has spent his career in business journalism, including 2 decades at the Wall Street Journal, where he was deputy managing editor and executive editor online. He was the Washington bureau chief at the Journal, as well as for CNBC. He was also president of the highly regarded Pew Research Center. And he has a new book, Tomorrow's Capitalist, My Search for the Soul of Business, just published by Hachette's Public Affairs imprint. So, Alan, welcome, and thanks very much for joining me today, and congratulations on the new book.
Thanks, Kevin, and thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Pleasure. Before we get into the book, though, I thought maybe a good way to sort of frame the conversation, because it's relevant to the points that you're making in the book and the themes that you're covering in the book. Maybe we could set the stage by looking at Davos and the World Economic Forum, from which you've just returned. Obviously, this was the first in-person gathering. Usually, it's held in January, but the first in-person gathering since the pandemic. So, I'm interested to know, you know, what you took away from the WEF this year. What's changed? How the outlooks were different. What was different other than warmer weather and no Russian oligarch parties this year?
Well, the Russian oligarch party is significant. Look, it has been 2.5 years. First of all, I returned from Davos with COVID, so I'm not particularly fond towards the experience at the moment. But I would say 2 things were different in that 2.5 years. One striking one: Davos, in its 40-plus year history, has been all about globalization. It was really part of the drive towards globalization. And it was interesting to be there this year with virtually no Russians and virtually no Chinese representatives. That was a big change. I mean, President Xi has spoken there in the past. I don't know if Putin's ever been. I know Medvedev, when he was president, was there. So it was kind of a stark reminder that the world of globalization is retreating. And the second thing I would say is there's a seriousness about climate change in particular. Climate change has always been one of the issues that sort of bopped along on the Davos agenda. But the corporate community has gotten so much more serious in the last couple of years. You saw that in Glasgow. You see it in the really kind of geometric increase in Fortune 500 companies making net zero 2050 commitments over the last two and a half years. And so I was impressed by, you know, not just talk, but an effort to take talk into action and figure out what the private sector could do in particular to sort of jumpstart the movement towards green hydrogen, green steel, green cement, carbon removal, and other technologies that we're going to need if we're going to have any chance of getting to net zero 2050.
So do you get the two follow-ups on that? Do you get the impression that, I mean, in some ways, the absence of the Russians and the Chinese is a metaphor for the bigger picture that we are seeing out there, which is this kind of division between the rules-based, democratic, rich country order and those who are these kind of revisionist and revanchist powers, most obvious examples being China and Russia. Was there a sense that, like, you know, this was an off year and next year when we go back to doing this in January, the Chinese and the Russians will be back? Or do you sense a permanent change on that front?
I think there's a fear that this may be a permanent change. I mean, there was a lot of talk about Russia and Davos. I didn't hear anybody who had a good endgame scenario of how we're going to come out of this. Everybody seems to be doubling down, hardening, and it's hard to even imagine going back to a world where we interact with Russia the way we did a year ago, 2 years ago. And China hangs out there more as a concern than anything else. But I can tell you the CEOs who I talk to, all of them have sort of war gamed. Gee, what if we weren't talking about Putin going into the Ukraine, but we were talking about Xi going into Taiwan? How would we respond? What would our action be? We've done some polling on this. Many companies are trying to reduce their exposure to China. So I think people are settling in for a very different kind of world than we've been accustomed to for the last 50 years.
And on the climate front, you talked about how prominent the subject was, and it has been for some time. How would you characterize the sort of the overall kind of mood on that front, considering that we obviously went through the pandemic and we saw a considerable downturn in global emissions as a result of no travel, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, now in this moment of war and in with the need for, continuing to pump oil, you've got this kind of discordant note where the president of the United States, who may be the greenest president we've ever had, is at the same time imploring the oil producers to pump more. Is there a sense that we're not going to make those threshold dates, and that therefore what we really need to be thinking about is risk mitigation as opposed to we're going to be able to head off the worst effects of climate change? Or are they not ready to throw in that towel?
I don't think they're throwing in the towel. I mean, everybody recognizes it's a really hard goal to get to. I hear a lot of people who think that what's happened with Russia is actually going to help. I mean, yes, of course, we now need more fossil fuels coming from other places to make up for the supply from Russia and to get us through the transition. But a lot of people are also using this as an additional prod to make the transition to cleaner technologies. No question. And understand, I mean, you've spent time in Davos. You have a lot of subcultures there. My subculture is the business. So when I talk about a greater seriousness about climate, it is from members of the business community. And I think there's a reasonable degree of optimism, not because they clearly see the path, but because they have a great deal of confidence in the inventiveness of the business community to deal with some of these tough technical problems that have to be solved, whether it's battery storage for a green grid or green hydrogen or some of the other tough technical problems that have to be solved in order to make this work.
And would you say there's a sense that in a certain way, this is the greatest business opportunity of all time, in a sense, but yeah. The other side of that is if you get it wrong, it's going to be, could be lights out for you, literally.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's interesting you say the greatest business opportunity of all times. You know, these conversations pre-pandemic tended to be a little dour, you know, even the phrase corporate responsibility, it's like, this is something you don't want to do, but you have to do for the good of the planet. It was like an obligation. It felt like a burden. And I think what's happened over the last couple of years is that more and more companies have said, wait a minute, this isn't a burden. This is an opportunity that if we get ahead of this, there's, you know, trillions of dollars is going to be spent on this transition. And if we get ahead of it, we can be the recipients of some of that. So I do think that's changed pretty dramatically. Look, if you think about it, Tesla pre-pandemic was kind of an interesting experiment, but look at its market cap. It wasn't a very big company. Tesla post-pandemic, you know, bigger than all the other auto companies combined. So that one example alone, I think, has made people realize, oh, my God, this isn't just something I need to do to be good to the world. This is a way I can make a lot of money.
So this is a good segue into your book, actually. And, if you look at your book, Tomorrow's Capitalist, and you open to the front flap, the quote in there is, it says, in an era of political and cultural extremism, America's corporate leaders have emerged as the pragmatic center of a movement for social and economic progress. Now, I can just see some of the cynical eyebrows out there getting raised about that. But I want to highlight the framing device that you used to start this book. You describe the Vatican Global Forum that was convened by Fortune and its then sister publication Time Magazine back in 2016 that brought together 100 global CEOs with Pope Francis in the Sistine Chapel to discuss, you know, his call for business to respond to the greater needs of the people of the world and of the planet itself. And I remember this vividly. We were involved. Colleagues of mine, like Kathy Lacey and others, were with you there. And, you know, a number of our clients participated and it meant something to them. So, and I know you're not saying that that one event alone catalyzed the movement that you're writing about here, but tell us, you know, tell us about this evolution that you've been witnessing and why you think it's real and why it's here to stay.
Sure. And look, this is a personal journey for me that I try and tell in the book. And I didn't come at this with the zeal of a reformer. I mean, I've been a lifelong journalist, and I really have always thought that my role was to explain the world, not to change the world. But after the Great Recession, because of my position, I probably have a unique opportunity to talk to a large number of CEOs about their jobs, about how they're leading, et cetera. It's what I do. I do it at our conferences. I do it for my podcast newsletter. And I found that after the Great Recession, the tenor of those conversations was changing pretty dramatically. I mean, some of this was public. You may remember that Bill Gates, who was just stepping down as CEO of Microsoft in 2008, gave a speech also in Davos at the World Economic Forum about the need for a more creative capitalism. And then Michael Porter, who is like the super business school professor at Harvard, started talking about shared value capitalism. And John Mackey at Whole Foods was talking about conscious capitalism. And there was, I think, Mark Benioff and compassionate capitalism and inclusive capitalism. And all of a sudden, everybody felt the need to put an adjective in front of capitalism. Like maybe the system wasn't serving our needs as well as it could or should. And this is mostly people who were capitalists who believed in the system, but felt that it could work better. The interesting thing about the Vatican meeting 2016, I see 2016 as kind of a critical year, because what happened that year, as you know very well, Kevin, early in the year was the Brexit vote in the UK. And I think every business leader said, oh, my God, what's going on here? We all said this is a bad idea, and yet the public did it anyway. Who's listening to us? And then in the U.S., you had this extraordinary election going on where Donald Trump was winning on the Republican side with a campaign agenda that was against globalization and against free trade, the things that had created these post-World War II companies. And on the other side, you had a self-proclaimed socialist or democratic socialist, if there's a big difference there, Bernie Sanders, almost winning on the Democratic side. In fact, Hillary Clinton told me after the primary that you may remember, she at one point said that she was a committed capitalist. She said that she thinks that actually hurt her in the primary. So you had business leaders saying, wait, what's going on here? Who represents us in this political conversation? And we got to figure out how to do what we do better, or we run the risk of losing our operating license. And I had several Fortune 100 CEOs say those very words to me. So that was part of what motivated us to bring a group to Rome. And we spent a full day in working groups. There were no political leaders there. It was just business leaders, big companies. We spent the first day saying, okay, what can you do? Not as charity, but using your superpowers, your business profit-making powers, what can you do to address some of these problems that the world is facing, whether it's climate or water or worker mobility? And really good conversations and actually some good actions came out of that conversation. Then we captured all of that, translated it, and took it to the Pope, and then met with the Pope the next day. And Kevin, you'll understand this, but this was not what anyone considered a business-friendly pope. He had just done his tour of Latin America, where he sounded pretty much like a socialist. And I think he was a little skeptical at first of these 100 business leaders coming in and meeting with him. But when he recognized the power that they wielded, and when he saw the creativity of the kinds of solutions that they were proposing, he got it, and ended up, after telling us he was only going to spend like 10 minutes for a quick group photo, he ended up spending a couple of hours and greeted each of the CEOs individually. So for me, it was a real turning point. And the CEOs who participated to a person said to us afterwards, you know, we have to keep this conversation going. There's much at stake. So we created our CEO initiative, Fortune CEO initiative, out of that, which is now a community of a couple hundred CEOs who are really focused on how do we maximize the positive social impact of our business at the same time we're maximizing profits.
So, you know, as you lay out your argument and what you're seeing evolve out there, obviously, at the beginning of the book, you touch a lot on, you know, what has prevailed, what's been the prevailing paradigm leading up into this moment, which is sort of the Milton Friedman kind of broad definition of the social role of the corporation and what its purpose is. And obviously, there are some evolution going on that right now. But I'm wondering, do you think that I understand that CEOs and boards and so on and so forth will come to different, you know, come to different positions, you know, on their own time scale, but some of that's determined by personal belief. Some of that's determined by the market that they happen to be in, the industry that they are in, the world in which they operate, et cetera. But do you find that the CEOs and the investors are on the same page, or is there this kind of is there still a lot of discordant notes on that front because of the need for profit, you know, the issues with workers and labor, the energy transition that companies are going to be going through, all of that's going to cost a lot to reshore and nearshore and diversify or create redundancies in supply chains is going to cost a lot of money in a world where capital is looking like it's going to be less abundant than it's been over the last couple of decades. Are they on the same page?
I don't know that I'd say they're 100% on the same page, but there's been an enormous convergence in the last couple of years. Over the course of the decade, when I would hear CEOs start to talk like this, I always followed up by saying, well, why? Why are you doing this? And the answer always started with their employees. My employees want me to. I want to be able to attract the best talent. This is what I need to do for the people who work for me. They want to work for a company that's doing good in the world. Over time, it started to include more consumers. I mean, consumers were always in favor of it. It's just, would consumers be willing to pay an extra penny for something that was perceived as green or better for the world or better treatment of their employees, et cetera? You started to see some of that. And then in the last few years, you really did see a pretty big change in investors. I mean, I'm told, you may have better numbers on this than I do, I'm told more than 40% of funds invested today are invested through some sort of ESG screen. Now, those screens, we've had a lot of publicity. The screens may be bullshit, but the point is 40% of money, there's at least an intention to think about goals other than pure profit. So I think that's pretty compelling. Larry Fink's newsletters, or not his newsletter, shareholder letter over the last couple of years has been another indication of that. So I think there's beginning to be a convergence. Look, here's the thing, Kevin. I wrote the book because I wanted to explore why is this happening. It became clear to me it wasn't a fad. It wasn't a bunch of woke CEOs trying to curry favor with Elizabeth Warren. Something fundamentally different was going on, and I wanted to understand what it was. And here's the most interesting fact that I ended up with along that journey. If you look at the Fortune 500 companies in the 1970s, and you look at their balance sheets, and you ask the question, where is the value coming from? More than 80% of the value on the balance sheets of Fortune 500 companies in the 1970s was physical stuff. It was plant, it was equipment, it was oil in the ground, it was inventory on the shelf. And so physical capital and by derivative financial capital mattered. You know, if you had access to capital, you could build the big plants. If you had the big plants, you were going to make the product. When you do the same exercise today, what you find is 85% of the value on the books, on the balance sheets of Fortune 500 companies is intangibles. It's intellectual property. It's computer code. It's brand value, the relationship that your brand has built up with consumers. It's stuff that's much less based in physical and financial capital and much more based in people. It's very human. And I think that's at the core of what we're talking about here. Corporations, to succeed in today's world, have to be focused way more on people, because people determine their success. People are the source of their value. And so we're really evolving to a much more human form of corporation. And all these other things, the focus on stakeholder goals, are kind of derivative of that fundamental change.
So you talk about this at length, and the entire section of the book is devoted to this, really. So I want to go back, though, to Davos for just a second, because I hear the same things you're hearing, and we read about it a lot as well. But at the same time, companies and leaders are expressing a great deal of frustration with how they're going to organize their people now, right? The whole question of back to work or remote working. A lot was made yesterday of Elon Musk's kind of, go pretend to work for somebody else if you don't want to come back to the office, tweets and memos and so on. Where is the discussion on that front right now? Because, you know, and it's going to lead me to my next question about what's coming down the pike. But this notion of, you know, how you're handling your workforce, and let's admit, we're really talking about the white collar workforce, the office workforce, because obviously those on the factory floor have to go to work. But how was that discussion in Davos?
I think there's a recognition. When we poll Fortune 500 CEOs, when we have polled them for the last 6 months and asked them what's top of mind for them, it's not Russia, it's not China, it's not cybersecurity, number one top of mind is talent. And I think that reflects, some of that is like the peculiar circumstances of this moment in history, right? We stimulated the economy in the middle of a pandemic that caused a lot of people to withdraw their labor from the market. So you had reduced supply, increased demand, bam, you know, that's pretty toxic. But that was only accelerating what had already become a trend. Once companies realized that their value and their success depends on their ability to attract great people, then great people end up in a position of power. I mean, you know, the Business Roundtable statement of 2019, which went from the Milton Friedman, hey, companies exist to serve the shareholder, to no, companies exist to serve all stakeholders, employees, customers, the planet, and shareholders. But really, if you analyze what the CEOs are saying, they've been super focused for the last 3 years on employees. Employees seem to have risen to the top of the stakeholder pile. And that's having a huge influence on this return to work. I got a cynical note from somebody this morning on the Elon Musk statement saying, well, Elon Musk need to reduce his workforce, and this is a way of doing it without having to do layoffs. You just chase them away. I can tell you most companies are going in the opposite direction. They are cutting deals with employees because that's what employees want. They want new flexibility. And if you want the best people, you're probably going to have to give them some.
So it strikes me that this journey that you've just been talking about, that a lot of CEOs have been on, or the epiphanies or whatever, you know, it has occurred in a very particular economic moment in our country's history. And that is an extended bull market with, you know, great, you know, generally speaking, great economic growth. In an era where rates were, you know, real rates were negative, essentially free money. Companies were playing with, and investors were playing with house money, low rates, no inflation. And it enabled, therefore, a lot of the ability to put principles before profit. I'm wondering what, as we look at these gathering storm clouds out there and a lot of talk of things that hadn't even been a part of the consumer lexicon for years, inflation, stagflation even, and now obviously talking about potential recession perhaps next year or in the next 2 years. What happens when all of this slams into that kind of an economic reality? Does it survive that? Or does the investor start to say, you know what, it's all great, but I need you to make me money?
Now, yeah, it's a good question, Kevin. You know, if you go back again to the Great Recession, if you remember before the Great Recession hit, there was kind of a burgeoning conversation among companies about climate that was pretty interesting. I mean, you had GE doing its whole eco imagination. You had US CAP, which is a coalition of big companies, including utilities, that was pushing for some kind of controls on carbon emissions. You even had two presidential candidates at the time, one from each party, John McCain and Barack Obama, who both favored putting controls on carbon emissions. And then the recession hit, and my perception is all that kind of went away. It's like exactly what you said. We got to focus on the bottom line. This climate stuff will have to wait. And if you roll back to March of 2020, when the pandemic hit and it became clear we were going into another recession, my first instinct was yours, which is, oh, it's going to happen again. And we're going to see all these stakeholder issues put on the back burner. And what was so interesting about 2020 was I was exactly wrong. Instead of causing those concerns to go away, it elevated them and accelerated them, in part because of the nature of the crisis, right? It was a stakeholder crisis. You had to worry about the safety of your employees and the safety of your customers. But then as a derivative of that, there was also increased attention on climate, huge increase in the number of companies in 2020 and 2021 that made net zero 2050 commitments. So that's part of what led me to write the book. I said, well, wait, this is not a short-lived cyclical phenomena. There's something more fundamental going on. And I think a lot of these pressures I write about in the book, about how companies are so much more dependent on talent than they were in prior days, none of those things are going to change with a downturn. So I'm convinced it's going to continue. It might slack off a little bit because companies don't have quite the same freedom of resources to lavish on their employees or on environmental projects. I don't think the focus is going to go away. And here's the other thing that happened. And we talked about this. The other thing that happened was you saw the conversation shift from things like environment as being a responsibility to things like environment and taking care of your employers being the way to succeed in business. So it's now seen as an opportunity to make money, to succeed. The one last thing I'll say about that, Kevin, is, you know, to me, this has always been in large part a question of time frame. Any of us can think of thousands of pernicious things that a company can do in the short term to boost its quarterly profits. You can put out bad products, you can despoil the environment, you can, you know, screw your employees. There's endless ways that you can do damage in the short term and boost your quarterly profits. But if you look over the longer term, those tend to disappear and the interests of society and the interests of the shareholder tend to converge. You can't be a successful business if the planet's on fire. You can't be a successful business if society is in revolt over inequality. So all those things, I think, are at play in what's going on right now with companies taking a longer-term view to their success.
You know, earlier you mentioned ESG, and obviously everything you've just been talking about is an element of that. And so clearly, you think that ESG as an organizing principle is something that's here to stay. But I wonder if you think that this is not static, right? There's a dynamic conversation going on here about, you know, how to meet ESG metrics or ESG targets or ESG ideals for that matter. It strikes me, you know, as I've just been, you know, as you know, I look at geopolitical risk for the most part. And one of the things that's been fascinating, of course, is that many for a long time would have not wanted, say, weapons manufacturers or defense contractors to be in an ESG portfolio. Yet it strikes me as clear that were it not for Lockheed Martin or Raytheon or others, that Ukraine would most likely be a wholly owned subsidiary of Russia right now. Anytime you see a picture of the iconic, heroic Ukrainian soldier, he's got a Javelin missile tube on his shoulder. So it seems to me that global S&G would be suffering a lot were it not for those companies right now. Yeah. Maybe they're not helping the E in Ukraine, but I mean, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
and same with fossil fuel companies. You know, we woke up after the invasion and realized that we had, particularly Europe, had put itself in hock to the Soviet Union because of its dependence on their fossil fuels, and we need to create more elsewhere in order to finance the transition to cleaner fuels. So I think that's true. I think, look, ESG is a horrendous acronym that was, I guess somebody at the UN came up with it. It's a little weird in that, you know, the S and the E can often push you in very different directions. And I can't even get people to agree on what the G means. Seems to be, you know, lots of different views. So it's not a very good framework. I wouldn't be surprised if we come up with another one that's better. I also think trying to do this strictly from the portfolio investment side is a little fraught. I mean, if 40% of funds in the market are invested with an ESG screen and ESG screens decide not to fund any coal plants, that just means that the other 60% of investors get a higher return when they do invest in coal plants. So I'm not sure that's a great way to change the world. But I get it, and I appreciate the impulse. I think part of what has to happen, let me put it this way. We spent literally centuries building the financial infrastructure around shareholder capital. You got the big four accounting firms. Everybody has their own finance departments. We've had accounting scandals and reforms. It took a long time to get that right, but we're pretty good at it now. We know how to measure return to shareholders. We're just beginning the process of learning how to measure return to stakeholders. There are a lot of companies working on it. There are a lot of different efforts at it, you know, measuring ESG. What is ESG? I mean, the interesting dispute recently has been the S&P ESG screen kicked Tesla out. Well, geez, I don't know about you, but I think Tesla's had a bigger effect on this movement towards companies taking climate seriously because it showed that there were business opportunities when you did it than any other company around. So I think we have a long way to go on the effective comparable measurement path, but it will happen over time.
Why do you think... I'd be interested in what your thoughts here are. Why do you think companies were so fast to react to the Russia invasion in Ukraine? Obviously, everybody's buffeted by political events all over the place, and yet I don't think we've ever seen an exodus like that from a otherwise viable market ever. Obviously, some were faster than others, but still.
No, never. I mean, the only thing that's even close was what happened with South Africa around the apartheid issue. And that played out over 15 years, not 15 days. It was extraordinary. And to me, this is the single biggest change of the last decade. And I think it's now starting. You're now starting to get some pushback to it. I mean, I can tell you as a journalist, 10 years ago, any kind of controversial geopolitical political event that didn't have a direct effect on the bottom line of a company's finances, you couldn't get any CEO to talk about it. They would hide under their desk and say, I'm not going there. My job is to run this company, not to talk about geopolitics or gun control or voting rights or whatever. And that started to change. Around 2015, Mark Benioff at Salesforce was one of the first. Remember, Indiana passed a so-called religious liberties law that was perceived as discriminating against gay people, the LGBTQ community. He said, I'm going to take my business out of Indiana unless you do something about this. And not too long after that, there was a similar event in North Carolina where the state passed restrictions on transgender access to public bathrooms. And it was not only California tech companies, it was Bank of America, the largest employer in the state, who said, you can't do that. You've got to change that law. And then you had episodes like Delta Airlines removing its discount program for people traveling to the NRA convention, Dick's Sporting Goods restricting gun sales, Walmart restricting gun sales. And of course, the big eruption was in the early days of the Trump administration when CEOs, after the Charlottesville riots, CEOs resigned from his advisory councils. Again, nothing like that had ever happened before. So this pattern of CEOs speaking out on social and political issues is really still fairly new. It's only been building over the course of the last decade. And I think what happened in Russia was kind of the fulfillment of that. Say, well, this is horrible. This goes against our values. As human-centered companies, we have to have values, and we have to be willing to stand up for them. Now, having said that, it was quite a progression to get to that point where thousands of companies in 15 days said we're out, including companies like McDonald's, which had spent three decades building up that business in Russia. Now, what's happened since then? You had this really embarrassing back and forth in Florida with Disney and its CEO, Bob Chapek, who at first did what CEOs 10 years ago would have done when Florida passed its law restricting conversations about gender identification. Chapek said, well, I'm not going to talk about that, and tried to stay out of it for a couple of weeks, and his employees revolted. He had some of his most valuable creatives in Hollywood saying, this is important to us. We've always been a great company for LGBTQ rights. You have to speak out. So finally he did speak out, and then Florida came back and said, well, we're taking away your special tax and operating status. I think a lot of CEOs looked at that and said, boy, I don't want to be in that mess. And then the other interesting one that's come up recently is Roe v. Wade. You know, if the Supreme Court changes Roe v. Wade, most of the big companies I know are willing to or already have put in place benefit programs that would pay for travel expenses outside the state to deal with a situation like that. But none of them want to talk about it. They have employees on both sides. It's a very, it's a very deeply felt question. No CEO wants to come out and attack the Supreme Court decision or whatever. So I think you're starting to, we've seen in our polling that you're starting to see some pushback about, hey, let's be careful here about when we speak out and when we act unilaterally and when we don't.
Yeah, and I think another one would be on the gun front. Obviously, we had some large financial institutions that said they were going to not continue to finance gun manufacturers. And then you have like the state of Texas push back and say, well, then you'll be locked out of state and municipal financing business in obviously one of the biggest states in the country. So
you've got 4,000 Salesforce employees who signed a petition to their CEO saying we should not let the NRA use our software. And the CEO saying, wait a minute, we're going to start firing our customers because we don't like their views. You know, where does that end? I think there's in the business community, there is a fear that this employee empowerment has gone a little too far.
So let's talk about the CEOs themselves and the profile of CEOs. As the world evolves, is the profile of the CEO going to have to evolve as well? You know, you spend several pages in the book actually talking about my chairwoman, Ursula Burns, and her evolution as a corporate leader. But you know, the reality of it is, you know, if you sort of put to one side for a second the Silicon Valley young entrepreneurs and whatnot, most of the CEOs of Fortune 100 companies are people who are, let's say, in their 50s or 60s. They basically came of age in this paradigm of globalization, as you kind of defined it at the beginning. All of that is in flux. Do you feel like that a lot of the, and obviously we're talking in great generalities here, even though you're giving excellent specific examples, but are these people as a class, you know, sort of well positioned to pivot in this fast changing world? Or do you think that it's going to require a different set of skills? And do you think that that next gen of CEO is going to maybe come from different backgrounds within the corporation than have been traditionally the feeders to the C-suite?
Yeah, I don't know about the second, but the first is a definite yes. It does require a different set of skills. I mean, many 20th century CEOs were engineers. And if you think about the 20th century corporation, it was really this kind of information hierarchy where you had people out in the field and they would, you know, they would do things and collect information, and the information would go up to the top, and the in the C-suite, they would formulate that into a strategy, and then they'd tell everybody what to do. So, you know, that was kind of the structure 50 years ago. And even in Jack Welch's day, I just finished reading David Gelis's book about Jack Welch. It was sort of like, I'm the person who has to bring it all, put it all together, make sense of it, and tell you what to do. But no one runs a really runs a company that way today. I mean, first of all, if you wait for that process, you're automatically going to be behind. You can't decisions can't come from the top. You have to empower people in the field in order to move fast enough to deal with the constant pace of change. And so the job at the top has become much less about telling people what to do and much more about inspiring them, motivating them, setting broad goals, moral guidelines, making the company an attractive place for them to work. It's just a very different kind of job, and therefore requires different qualities. You know, the interesting word, I mean, and I come from a position of having covered this stuff now for four decades, so I do have some long-term perspective on it. The word that in the last 2 years, if you say to a CEO, what are the skills that a CEO needs to in this environment? One word that comes up frequently and quickly is empathy, which I can't remember hearing 15 years ago. But the need to be able to listen, to be able to understand, to be able to empathize, and then take rapidly changing circumstances and incorporate them into the corporate plan. I mean, that's where I think you need a very different set of skills than you did 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Do you think a lot of CEOs, particularly at the largest companies, are they too much in the bubble? In other words, you know, you've talked about how some of them have gotten buffeted around by, you know, what their employees and other stakeholders wanted versus what, you know, a governor wanted or what have you, and that they were a little tone deaf because they see everything on the spreadsheets and they see all the internal reports and so on and so forth, but they're not actually out there in the field or out there in their with their consumers to the degree that perhaps they would pick up on some of this grassroots thinking.
Well, there are obviously plenty of examples of CEOs being tone deaf, but I actually think it's kind of the opposite, Kevin. The CEOs, this is their lived reality. This is what they put up with every day. You know, I was having this conversation with Ed Bastian, the CEO of Delta Airlines, and he was asking about the book, and I was talking about some of the pushback that comes from people who think that either this isn't real or it's just PR or it's a bunch of woke CEOs. And, you know, I expressed some surprise that there's still so many skeptics that this is real. And he just looked at me and he said, well, none of those people run large companies, because anybody who's running a large company is feeling the pressure intensely every day. So, you know, they get it. In fact, one of the big issues, I think, is that there's a disconnect between the people at the top and the people a couple levels down who are working on traditional management, you know, KPI-based tracks and don't really know or understand how stakeholder goals and pressures should filter in to their actions and decisions. So I think the CEOs get it better than everyone else. And one of the anxieties they feel is like, how do I prepare the next generation for the whirlwind of a job that they will be stepping into?
And, you know, implicit in what you're just talking about right there is something else you bring up in the book, which is that none of this and none of what we're trying to accomplish can happen kind of in a vacuum or with everybody, you know, siloed, and that this requires collaboration, you know, not just within companies, but between companies, and also very importantly, between between corporate leaders and public policy and government leaders as well. And that, you know, we're in this environment that has changed where the largest competitor to the United States is a, you know, is a centralized economy, a top down run economy, where even the ostensibly private sector is an extension of the foreign and economic policy of the Chinese Communist Party, essentially. And that a lot of the challenges that we have, you know, you made the point earlier, a lot of these big changes are going to take years to implement. That's going to out, you know, it's going to outlast the tenures of these CEOs themselves. It requires commitment, and it gets really kind of close to a new version of industrial policy in a sense. But how do you see, how do they see that dynamic? Okay.
We have the benefit of having just lived through one of the great examples of industry competition combined with collaboration combined with public policy in what happened with vaccines during the pandemic. I mean, remember, the drug companies prior to the pandemic were, in a lot of polls, the most hated companies in yep. business because yep. they were seen as sort of clinging to their intellectual property and charging ridiculous prices. And you had these scandals with Martin Shkreli and Valeant and so forth, opioids. So it was an industry in complete disrepute. And the transformation that happened during the pandemic, where they were able to focus on a social need, not I mean, I think at the end of the day, they will do fine financially, but it was a social need. It was about saving lives, focus on doing that, turn around a vaccine in one-tenth of the time that it had normally required, create cooperative arrangements among themselves. I mean, some of the companies that didn't win the vaccine race then turned their manufacturing facilities over to those who did. It required government involvement to do some forward purchasing and things like that. Just an extraordinary an extraordinary example of the power of business correctly harnessed and with some combination of social focus and willingness to cooperate when it makes sense of what they could do. I think what a lot of people have been talking about since then is, gee, okay, that's what we did in a crisis. How do we keep that going? Because just, you know, the climate or other diseases or other big problems we have, we could definitely conquer those things if we could recreate that magic that hit the pharmaceutical industry for that 2-year period.
You know, so I know you're primarily focused on the business world and business leaders, but in what we're just talking about here, let's talk about the other collaborator here, which is government leaders. And, you know, the example that you give is going to be used forever, I suspect, because it is so successful. But again, we were in a war, effectively, at that time. And what you're talking about is how do you keep that collaborative spirit alive and efficient? Because I think prior to that, you know, a lot of our experience has been that government oftentimes is an impediment to business. It is, you know, or we've seen tech CEOs in front of Senate committees and the like, where clearly the elected officials have no idea the business model of these companies, let alone the algorithms that are behind what they do and so on. And so they come with these sort of blunt instruments rather than help or a surgical scalpel to hit, you know, what needs to be done. How about that side of the equation?
Yeah.
Do you think that government and regulators are keeping up in the way that they need to?
Yeah, it's a really important discussion. Look, what this goes back to the way you started this conversation. I mean, when I started my career 4 decades ago, business clearly defined the right wing of the spectrum. Papers out of the American Enterprise Institute was funded 100% by business that defined the conservative side. And then you had, you know, a progressive wing on the other side. And what's been so interesting about the last couple of decades is business has moved very much to the center on issues like climate, on issues like social justice, diversity and inclusion. businesses are the centrists. They no longer define the right. And as a result, but they also realize that these are things they used to think were government responsibilities. I mean, that was kind of, in a way, that was one of the problems with the Friedman paradigm was, hey, not our problem. Yes, inequality is growing rapidly. That's a government thing, not our thing. The climate is about to be destroyed. That's a government problem. That's externalities. You handle that. It's not our job. Our job is to make a profit for our shareholders. And so I think it's largely a good thing that companies have realized that those externalities need to become internality. They do need to take responsibility for it. But I think they also know at the end of the day, it does require public-private partnership. You need government involved. The climate challenge would be so much easier if you could sit down with reasonable politicians and say, hey, you know, a carbon tax would actually help, a price on carbon of some sort would help create the right incentives to make these things happen. And you could actually raise some money in the process. So why don't we figure out a way to do it? I think there are a lot of businesses that would participate in that conversation. There's just no politicians who will participate in that conversation. And you can see it across the line. There are a lot of really interesting experiments going on in businesses today on the training front, not just how do we train our employees, but how do we train members of society more broadly so we have a broader base of employers and we do what we can as employers to restart the escalator of mobility. But there's a lot that business can do, but at the end of the day, you really need partnership with government. So I look, Kevin, one thing the critics say is, well, business is responsible for the failures of government because of the things you said, because it spent decades lobbying against government, trying to lower taxes. So effectively defund the government. I think there's some truth to that. And I'm not sure the business community is quite yet figured out how to square those, the old impulse with the new impulse. Last thing I'll say on this, the most interesting case of that is taxes. You know, the business community has worked so hard for so long to do everything within its power to minimize taxation on corporations. And at some point, if you're really thinking about your positive impact on society, you got to rethink that approach. I mean, taxes are the main way you contribute to society. And so paying as close to nothing or nothing as possible is probably not the right answer. I heard the CEO of one of the big four accounting firms told me that in the last year or two, and only in the last year or two, their audit people have found themselves in conversations with companies about tax strategies, asking not just, is this legal, which they've always asked, but is this moral? Is this the right thing to do? That's new. I don't mean to suggest that that's a majority of companies, but I think that is going to have to start to change to make this movement a full reality.
That's really interesting. Look, I can't let you go without asking the following, which is, you know, probably the subject of an entire conversation. Maybe we'll be able to have down the road sometime. But since you're here, and you know, you've had a decades long career in journalism and in media, and I just have to ask, you know, where you see things kind of going, or what the state of the union is on that front. I mean, you and I both grew up in a world where the decision was essentially made: you're going to watch Cronkite or you're going to watch ABC tonight at 6:30. You know, like those, you had three choices essentially, and your family was going to spend that half hour. But they were all pretty much singing from the same hymn sheet. And you know, even the New York Times maybe has found the economic model that that is going to work moving forward, and yet, for many people, it's no longer viewed as the newspaper of record. It's sort of like that's the liberal New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal is the, you know, is the print arm of the Murdoch empire or what have you. Everybody's in their corner, and there is no kind of what do you think is going on, and what's the role of the media? Can we get any of that back? Is there an obligation here that we're not meeting on that
front? Yeah, I think it's very sad. It's been a very sad thing to watch. And I agree with the way you put it. I mean, when I started my career, if you talked about the mainstream media, that phrase actually had some meaning. a pretty small group of people running the big newspapers and the three wire services and the three nightly news shows. And that had its own problems, right? They probably spent too much time having lunch and drinks together, too much time talking to each other, probably too much groupthink. But what you have now is the polar opposite. Anybody with a computer is part of the world of journalism. So there are no standards and there's no quality control. Things that I took for granted that were part of being a journalist are not taken for granted out there today. And of course, then we have the pernicious effect of, you know, Russian bots or whatever trying to put information out there. I think Facebook was a bad player in this. But by insisting, oh, we're just a platform, we're not responsible for what you're reading, when, of course, its algorithms were hugely responsible for what got magnified and what you read. I mean, we reached a point, I was at the Pew Research Center when we saw that more than 50% of Americans were getting their news from Facebook. Say, wow, what does that mean? So I think it's very sad, and I don't know how we get back. The problem is, it was a function of consumer choice, right? I mean, I come from an economics background. This was people were given the option of reading news, whatever news, however they wanted to, and now they have that option. So they're getting the news they want. But I'm not sure how society survives if the quality and the credibility of that news is so called into question. So I think it's going to be a long, hard road back, and will probably require a lot of public education. We probably need to develop the next generation to be much more discerning readers, so they can do what I normally do when I read a piece, to say, Jesus, is this a publication that corrects its errors? Simple test, right? Some do, some don't. If they don't, I wouldn't read them. Is this a reporter who made any effort to get the other side of the story? You can usually tell that when you read the story. If they didn't, throw them out. Is this somebody who is always writing on one side of the story? Well, if they, then, you know, that might be fun for you if you agree ideologically. But if you really want news, you're going to have to look for somebody who's looking for a broader view. So anyway,
But when you look at the sort of the benchmark publications, you know, the Times, the Journal, the FT, the Economist, Fortune, you know, when you look at the young people who are joining those as journalists, how do you feel about the caliber and quality, the hunger, the insistence on getting to the truth? Is it the same caliber that we've always had? And so therefore,
I think so.
We've got the talent. We just need.
I think they're great people going into journalists, and they're great people working at all of those organizations. It's just, and I do believe that paywalls improve the quality of what's produced, because there's a difference between writing to attract repeat committed readers and writing to attract eyeballs. And so I do think the increasing use of paywalls, which we have at Fortune, the New York Times has, et cetera, does improve the quality of what's produced. The problem is, it creates a world where those who pay get better, those who don't. I mean, I think The Economist is a great publication. I still think The Wall Street Journal is a great publication. I think The New York Times is a great publication, although I accept what you said, that it seems to embrace a worldview that I don't necessarily always agree with. But at least I know when I read something in the New York Times that they have some standards of factual accuracy and fact-checking and correcting their errors and so forth. So I can depend on the information more than if it's just coming across some anonymous feed on Facebook.
Well, as I said at the beginning, Fortune magazine is now 93 years old, and thanks to your stewardship, before too long, we'll be celebrating its centennial. I think it's a great, you know, it's a great iconic brand. So congratulations on that. And again, Alan Murray's new book is Tomorrow's Capitalist. It's available everywhere. including even Amazon. And so, you know, please pick it up. And Alan, I just want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with me and our guests, our audience today. We very much appreciate it. I want to thank everybody for joining us. We'll be back in a couple of weeks.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin Kachawara. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Teneo Insights. If you have any questions about any of the topics we cover, please reach out to us at teneoinsights@teneo.com. See you next time.